I'm Jim Benson, and you're listening to TV Time Machine on Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ, and archived on TVTimeMachine.com.
Nothing so needs reforming as other people's habits. Fanatics will never learn that, though it be written in letters of gold across the sky. It is the prohibition that makes anything precious.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're about to embark on a journey through a vast galaxy that traverses memory, generations, and popular culture. A magical trip through time as we meet the men and women of yesterday and today who have shaped not only what we see on TV, but the way we see ourselves. I'm Jim Benson. Join me, if you will, on an exploration of television's past, present, and future as we climb aboard the TV Time Machine. Our destination subject today will be the PBS documentary Prohibition and the remarkable career of filmmaker Ken Burns. Mr. Burns himself will join us to help navigate this particular excursion into the realms of history, documentaries, and classic television creations. We'll begin our exciting and fun-filled odyssey right after these brief messages.
I was born Mary Tyler Moore.
Jesse Donald Knotts.
Fred McFeely Rogers.
Leslie Moonves.
Isabel Sanford.
Leslie Renee Stahl.
Robert Edward Turner.
Regis Francis Philbin.
Aaron Spelling.
Since 1999, the Archive of American Television has been preserving the memories, knowledge, and insights of the men and women whose talents and vision have helped shape this remarkable medium. Over 500 video interviews with these TV legends are now available on the Archive of American Television website at metvlegends.org. There, you can sign up to receive news, updates, and also become a sponsor to help preserve television history for generations to come. That's metvlegends.org.
The mythological proportions of Star Trek provide something that's missing in people's consciousness, psyche.
The Archive of American Television, capturing television history, one voice at a time. Today on the TV Time Machine, we are proud to welcome a gentleman whose remarkable chronicles of American history are forever now part of television history, Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker, Ken Burns. Over a 30-year span, Mr. Burns has made full use of the medium's potential to edify and enlighten, turning a vast wasteland into a vast garden of lyrical masterpieces documenting the American and human experience. The Civil War, baseball, jazz, the war, and the national parks are among the more than 20 extraordinary films Mr. Burns has brought to both the small and large screens. Over the next few segments, Ken Burns will not only help us explore virtually every aspect of his remarkable contribution to television, but will also delve into his brand new documentary premiering Sunday, October 2nd on PBS, Prohibition. Again, for those of you intrepid enough to belly up to the bar, feel free to open up a tab as we slip from the restraints of the present and make a toast to a rather spirited past. Ken, thank you for coming on board the TV Time Machine.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Ken, I understand that you were born in Brooklyn, New York.
I was, although that's a little bit of a misnomer. My parents lived in Manhattan, but my mother had a job at a hospital in Brooklyn.
I see.
And I guess got free or reduced maternity, and that's how I ended up being born there. And then we left New York almost right away. My father was a cultural anthropologist and took us to the highest village in all of Europe, occupied year-round, a little quaint French farming town called Saint-Véran, and I spent the first year there.
How would you describe your growing up in terms of your friends, experiences, and interests?
Well, I think my childhood is overshadowed by an enormous tragedy, which is that my mother got sick when I was very young, 3 years old, and there was never a moment when I wasn't aware that she was not only sick but also potentially dying, and then she did die when I was 11 years old, a few months short of my 12th birthday. You can imagine how that clouded and filtered everything. And if you think about the kinds of things that I do, I wake the dead. I try to go in and and sort of resuscitate or breathe life into moments in American history. And there's obviously a very intimate and personal thing born out of the tragedies of my childhood that might account for that passion in trying to wake up the past.
Now, ultimately, you attended Hampshire College in
Yeah.
Massachusetts. Now, how did that academic experience impact your life?
Well, you know, it was, I don't recognize, Jim, the person who went into Hampshire and the person that came out. It completely rearranged my molecules, and particularly in the person of my mentor, a still photographer named Jerome Liebling, who just recently passed away at the age of 87, a really
Right.
very close friend, and as well as teacher. And it was his opening me up to the power of individual images to convey complex information that sort of set me on my way. But he had a much broader humanistic sense of social justice and responsibility and giving back, a wonderful teacher in which the time you spend in class was only a fraction of the way in which he imparted his way of seeing, his being. And I feel still extraordinarily grateful. I don't think if there had been Hampshire College or a Jerome Liebling, you and I would be talking.
Growing up, I had a book called The World Series. I love baseball. I was about 9 years old, and I would faithfully read this book and absorb myself into it. And it chronicled every year of the World Series and had these magnificent individual photographs that I could just stare at for minutes, hours. What is it about still photographs, and what is it about the pull of history, why it's more intriguing? Why is the past more intriguing than the present?
Well, I think in some ways, you know, a lot of people don't feel that. They think the past is boring, and I just don't get it, because as Harry Truman said, the only thing that's really new is the history you don't know. I'm so passionately drawn to our history. I think life is tough. You know, none of us are getting out of this experience alive, and it seems chaotic, and we superimpose our art and our rationalism, our faith, our relationships, the stories we tell as a way to keep the wolf from the door. And what I find in history, and what I think I heard in your question, was that as we go back to the past, we can develop not only a relationship to it, but we know full well the past is gone, we're never going to get it back. But history is a set of questions we in the present are asking of the past, and so it cannot help but be informed by our own hopes and our own wishes, our own dreams, and obviously also our own fears and anxieties as well. And so by going into the past, we can sometimes create the frame, the structures, the order that might be lacking in the sort of unknowingness of what's going on now and in the future. And so I find that history is an extraordinary guide. I mean, our recent film on Prohibition is so stunningly contemporary that it's hard, you're hard-pressed to say, oh my goodness, this actually did take place more than three quarters of a century ago. How is that possible?
Speaking of history and education, usually whenever you hear education mentioned, certainly, you know, in a social or political sense, the emphasis seems to be on math and science. And rarely, I think, is the emphasis placed on history. I think that's impacting how young people are learning now, because I'm running into more and more younger people who have absolutely no idea what happened prior to 1990, let alone in the, you know, 40s, 50s, in the 19th century.
Yeah, it's a terrifying thing to really contemplate, Jim, because it will reduce our country to second-class status if we don't understand the kind of rudimentary historical stuff. We've gutted our schools. We've made them secondarily important. We live in a media culture. People are working way too hard and way too long, and our kids suffer, and we blame it on our schools, and to some extent they bear a great deal of responsibility, but ultimately we all do. And when we wake up to this, we say, well, the only thing you really know how to do is, you know, add and subtract and know some science, because that's the only way you'll get through. But the great gift of the United States is the powerful history we have, the inspirational history we have, and the kind of humanism that we bring to the world. And I don't mean to be that to say that in a way that's exclusive of faith. Like, one of the great gifts of our country is the ability to worship God as we see fit. And so I think that we've missed the ball here on education. And, you know, I make films. I made a film a few years ago in the Second World War. I was stunned to find out that an unacceptably large number of graduating high school seniors thought, if they thought at all, that we fought with the Germans against the Russians in the Second World War. A study came out just a few weeks ago that said something like only 9% of fourth graders could recognize a picture of Abraham Lincoln. And for crying out loud, he's on the $5 bill. We just don't care. We live in an all-consuming and thereby, we assume, forgettable present, blissfully ignorant of the powers the past lives and stories and moments have over this moment, indeed our unknown future. And I think we have been paralyzed by this historical amnesia. And, you know, Jay Leno has his walking, which leaves you laughing, but in the most terrifying kind of way, when people are sort of almost proud of the ignorance that they can't tell you who the vice president is or how many senators there are.
Yes.
Basic stuff. And so, you know, we hope in our little niche that we're at least some bulwark, and we see the ways in which the stories sometimes inspire kids and adults to want to learn more, to read more, to look more, explore more, get up off the couch and turn off the TV set and go visit a national park or the battlefield at Gettysburg or some such thing.
Well, fortunately, you are really doing a public service and a social service, because I think you're getting through to a lot of people who otherwise would be incredibly ignorant about history.
Well, you know, it's funny. The word history is mostly made up of the word story.
Yes.
And we forgot that. Somewhere along the line, we decided that, oops, we'd neglected to tell history. Well, let's just go back and make sure they know these dates and these facts and these events. And quite rightly, people rebelled. What is the point of that? I do not understand its relevance. But if you expand to the back half of that word, and look at the word story and start to tell stories, everybody's drawn in.
Yes.
I mean, I can get anybody interested in any aspect of American history. And once you've done that, then the dates, they just come naturally, or they're organically attached. It's important to know what they are because you're so passionately interested in it. But distracted as we are, we think that if we just wear the right blue jeans and wear the right perfume and drive the right car, everything will be all right. And of course, everything will not be all right. The vicissitudes and troubles and tribulations that afflict almost everybody will eventually enter in. And I can tell you right now that besides one's health, one of the greatest armors you could have is your ability to know where we came from. Because if you don't know that, then you can't possibly know where you are and where you're going. And that's particularly true in tough times. There are lots of people in this country suffering, and history actually provides you with a kind of energy to go forward. I mean, people say to me, this is as bad as the Great Depression. And I go, no, it's not. In the Great Depression, the animals in the zoo in some cities were shot and the meat distributed to the poor. If that's happening, then I'll say we're in trouble. But what can we learn from the Depression? What did we do? How did we solve it politically and economically and socially? What did we do to band together? How do we come together as a country? These are the great teachings of history.
Ken, what was the genesis of your Civil War documentary?
Well, it's interesting. I had made a number of what we say one-off specials for PBS of my own inclinations on the Brooklyn Bridge, on the Shakers, on the Statue of Liberty, on Huey Long, on the Congress, on the painter Thomas Hart Benton. And every single one of them had as its defining element the Civil War. And after a while, you begin to say, wait a second, I got to deal with this. This is clearly the most important event in American history. The founding is important, but the first great test came in the Civil War, and the fact that we came through it, the issues that still bedevil us today were the issues then. How do we understand it? You know, if we're talking about the role of government, we're talking about race, we're talking about all the major central themes of American life, They're all there on the Civil War. I had to do it. I was drawn inexorably to the subject, and I found that people had a very superficial view of what had happened, and they almost reveled in the fact that they could explain it. And it seemed impossible to me that something that took really nearly tore the country in two, but took 620,000+ lives. Well, we ought to know what happened, not just study the causes and then the effects, but what actually took place at Bull Run 1 and 2 and Antietam and Gettysburg and Vicksburg and in fact, all the other myriad battles, 10,000 places, we said in our introduction, that the Civil War took place.
Well, throughout the Civil War's episodes, there are many, many moving moments, but perhaps none more so than in the following clip.
If I do not return, my dear Sarah, never forget how much I loved you, nor that when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name. Forgive my many faults and the many pains I have caused you. How thoughtless, how foolish I have sometimes been. But oh, Sarah, if the dead can come back to this earth and flit unseen around those they love, I shall always be with you in the brightest day and the darkest night. Always. Always. And when the soft breeze fans your cheek, it shall be my breath, or the cool air, your throbbing temple. It shall be my spirit passing by. Sarah, do not mourn me dead. Think I am gone, and wait for me, for we shall meet again.
Sullivan Ballou was killed a week later at the First Battle of Bull Run.
Ken, tell us the story of how that extraordinary moment from the Civil War came to be.
Well, I had assembled a body of nearly 24 distinguished historians to advise us on it. And with the exception of Barbara Fields, a remarkable professor of history at Columbia University who's in the film, very few had sent us the first-person material we had been requesting. And then one day, unannounced, came a letter from Robert Johanson, a great scholar of the causes of the Civil War and Lincoln and now deceased. And in it was essentially a very perfunctory, not even Dear Ken, but this is taken from the diary of so-and-so, the letter of which you excerpted part of, and then the last line that our narrator, David McCullough, read. I was so moved as I read it out loud that I made a Xerox copy of it, and it wasn't the letter, but I made a Xerox copy of the letter that Robert Johanson had sent to us, and I put it in my pocket. This was in 1985, 86, and it still is in my back pocket to this day. It's fallen apart. But it is, I knew exactly where it would go. It wouldn't go in the Battle of Bull Run, but in fact at the end of the first episode, after that battle's taken place, and 20 minutes later, just to set the stage of what is this emotional archaeology that we're doing? What are the real stakes? That these are not just arrows on a map, but in fact human beings, and each human being has a life so full that he could, in a short few sentences, say, you know, what every man wishes he could say to the woman he loves and what every woman wishes her man could say to him and become an indelible thing. Let me tell you that besides your playing of that today, it's been read or played 999 other times in America.
Yes.
At a wedding, at a renewal of vows, at a memorial service, at something. And it seeped into the consciousness of the country, along with the music. That was a piece called Ashokan Farewell, the only piece of music not contemporary to the Civil War, but written by one of the session musicians I had used in my, and continue to use in my early films, Jay Unger. And it, like the letter, is just now broadly part of who we are. And it says a lot about a people that we would be unabashed about our relationship to the powerful. This is a letter about love. It is a letter about the love of country. It is a letter about the love of government. It is a letter about the love of cause and what that government has asked this person to do. It is, of course, a letter about the love of family and children and of one's wife in this case, but also the deeper sort of transcendent love of all time that we all hope. Again, the inscrutable mathematical equation where, in this case, word and emotion, word and music, word and voice and circumstance all add up, one and one equaling three. And that's, of course, the way we would hope it would be.
What is it about the Civil War itself that touches people's hearts and souls even after all this time, a century and a half?
It's on so many levels, it would almost take us hours to even do the basic justice to it. It is the most important event in American history. Everything that came before led up to it. Everything since has, in some ways, however seemingly small, is a consequence of it. But it represents the best of us in a funny way. How is it that when we murdered 620,000 of our own people, you know, as many people dying in that internal civil war as in died in most of all the other wars we fought, what is it? But it is about forgiveness and reconciliation, heroism and leadership, a sense of renewal and the fact that our country could be remade. When Abraham Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address on November 19, 1863, he was taking the formation of our country, July 4, 1776, the Declaration of Independence, the famous second sentence of the Declaration, "We hold these truths to be self-evident," and saying, okay, that was Act One. Now Act Two begins. Here we are. Let us really say that we mean it. Because, of course, when Thomas Jefferson wrote those words, when he was able to distill a century of Enlightenment thinking into one remarkable sentence, we also forget that he owned more than 200 human beings as he wrote that sentence.
That's right.
Those 200 human beings whom he did not pay for their incredible labor provided him with the time to become the polymath, the Renaissance man that we quite correctly see him as, and set in motion contradictions that would inevitably lead to our civil war, and contradictions that are with us still to this day, that have to do with race, that have to do with government, that have to do with the individualism and the collectiveness of our American life, of our Puritan streak as well as our prurient streak, of our greed as well as our generosity. All of these things are embodied in the Civil War, and it will be, because of its huge consequence, one of the best teachers we will ever have, and will continue to be as long as there is a United States.
Well, we're going to have to take a little break from our fascinating journey, but never fear. I'll be back in a lightning flash with filmmaker Ken Burns, who is traveling with us on the TV Time Machine.